skies, daytime highs 10 below to 1 above. We continue with All Things Considered on KAXE.
Credit card interest rates are at near record highs right now.
So President Trump is calling for a 10% cap on those rates starting today.
We will get you more details on this plan. Today is Tuesday, January 20th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. New inequalities are forming in the West African country of Benin as it tries to modernize its cities.
You have one child who died. She has 12 years because no hospital.
Also, support groups for people with unhealthy emotional attachments to AI chatbots.
And a new record, the highest attended in-arena game in U.S. women's hockey history.
It was electric just to be in the stadium. Everyone's just so excited to be witnessing what ended up being history.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Department of Justice has issued subpoenas for Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, the state's Attorney General Keith Ellison, and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey. The Trump administration alleges the Democrats have been obstructing the immigration enforcement surge in the state's two largest cities. Walz, Ellison, and Frey have condemned the crackdown as dangerous, citing the fatal shooting of a 37-year-old woman by an immigration officer. Today, President Trump defended how federal agents have been operating.
They're going to make mistakes sometimes. ICE is going to be too rough with somebody, or, you know, they're dealing with rough people. They're going to make a mistake sometimes. It can happen. We feel terribly. I felt horribly when I was told that the young woman who was had the tragedy. It's a tragedy. It's a horrible thing. Everybody would say, ICE would say the same thing.
Trump administration officials have previously described the woman, Renee Macklin Good, as a domestic terrorist who attempted to ram federal agents. More than 250 tech professionals from some of the biggest companies in Silicon Valley are urging their bosses to pressure the White House to pull federal immigration officers out of American cities. NPR's John Ruich reports they say there's precedent.
An online petition has been signed by employees at Google, Apple, Meta, OpenAI, and many other companies. It references President Trump's October decision not to send immigration forces into San Francisco. Trump said at the time he got, quote, a great call from some incredible people who persuaded him to hold off from surging federal agents into the city. Among them were NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang and Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce. The online petition calls on tech leaders to pick up the phone to the White House again to demand that ICE withdraw from U.S. cities. It also urged them to cancel contracts with ICE and to speak out publicly against ICE's violence. It's not clear how many tech companies will heed those calls. John Ruich, NPR News.
Two members of the DOGE initiative assigned to the Social Security Administration may have violated the Hatch Act, according to court documents. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more.
Court filings say the DOGE employees were secretly in touch with an advocacy group seeking to overturn election results. That potentially violates the law preventing government employees from using their jobs for political purposes. The matter is now in the hands of the Office of Special Counsel. This update is one of many revisions to testimony made last year by Social Security Administration officials in a case over DOGE data access. The document also reveals DOGE employees may have inappropriately transferred sensitive data outside the organization, both through email and an unauthorized third-party server. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
Stocks sank on Wall Street today after President Trump threatened to hit European countries with new tariffs over his attempts to take over Greenland. The S&P 500 fell more than 2%. The Dow dropped more than 1.7%. This is NPR News. International health officials will meet in a few months to reevaluate the United States' measles-free status. Experts fear the virus has regained a foothold and that the U.S. may soon follow Canada in losing the achievement of having eliminated it. The evaluation comes a year after the West Texas measles outbreak began. Scientists are investigating whether multiple U.S. outbreaks are linked. Elon Musk is pumping $10 million to back a Senate candidate in Kentucky. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, it's the latest indication that the tech mogul plans to have an active role ahead of the midterm elections.
Musk donated to a group supporting Nate Morris, the Republican in the primary race to succeed Senator Mitch McConnell. Morris, who has ties to Vice President J.D. Vance, is a CEO based in Lexington who is critical of the Republican establishment. He's considered an underdog in the contest to follow McConnell. The money represents the largest yet for Musk in the midterm election cycle. Musk spent nearly $300 million to back Trump in 2024 and assumed a high-profile role in the administration, but after the two became estranged, Musk claimed he was done with politics and even threatened to start his own party. But now, Musk is funneling millions into a super PAC to push nominees who position themselves as populist pro-business candidates. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Second Lady Usha Vance is pregnant with her fourth child, a boy, due in late July. It's the first time a second lady has had a baby while in the White House. Presidents like John Tyler and Grover Cleveland had children during their terms. Vice President J.D. Vance says he's grateful for the doctors and staff who are helping take care of the family. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Lows tonight, 4 below to 6 above with a slight chance of snow and light southwest wind. There's more ahead on All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
Is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump says that banks are ripping off Americans who use credit cards. Interest rates are at near record highs. And Trump has called for a 10% cap on those rates starting today. But it's unclear if that will ever happen. NPR's Stephen Bissaha has been covering this and joins us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, good to be with you, Efsa.
Hey. Okay, so just catch us up here. What exactly has Trump said about credit card interest rates?
Well, he really did go after the banks on this. Here he is talking to reporters on Air Force One about banks and their credit card interest rates a couple weeks ago.
They've really abused the public. The credit card companies have totally abused it. I'm not going to let it happen.
And those credit card rates, they are high. Mm-hmm. I mean, just 5 years ago, credit card rates were around 16% on average. And that was a lot back then. But they've only shot up more since then. In November, they were at 22%.
Wow.
So Trump recently wrote on Truth Social, he wants a 10% cap on those rates. So dropping it down a lot. And during that Air Force One flight, he said if banks do not comply with his cap by today, January 20th, they will be in violation of the law. Now, we are at this deadline, but Trump has not announced how he'd actually enforce this, be it through executive order or something else.
Yeah, does the president even have the legal authority to require a change like this?
It's unclear what authority Trump would rely on to do this. He'd likely have to go through Congress. And there is a bipartisan Senate bill from last year that would cap rates at 10%. There's also another one in the House. Neither has seen much movement yet, but, you know, Trump's backing could change that. The White House did put out this list today for what they're calling 365 wins in 365 days. Today, of course, being a year since Trump's second inauguration. And number 88 is Trump, quote, directed credit card companies to cap interest rates, which does make this sound voluntary, at least so far.
Sort of. I mean, to be fair, Stephen, why are credit card rates so high right now?
Well, like, with any kind of interest rate in the U.S., one of the biggest factors is whatever's going on with the Federal Reserve, specifically the Fed's interest rates. That number has been high in recent years, and that's part of the reason credit card rates are also high. Debt. And that's a big risk for banks because unlike a secured loan like a mortgage, they don't get your house if you default. They just have to eat the loss. But Brian Shearer says there's another factor. He is with Vanderbilt University and researched the consequences of a 10% cap. He says banks are incentivized to keep rates high because they make a lot of money on credit cards.
This is the bank's cash cow. They make 6 times the profit on credit cards as they do everything else.
His research found a cap like this would save Americans around $100 billion, specifically Americans with credit card debt.
Okay, that sounds good, but could a cap cause any problems for people with debt?
Yeah, like I asked Sarah Rathner about that. She's with the financial advice website NerdWallet and is their expert on credit cards. And she said there could be serious consequences that could hurt some Americans. Banks might lower customers' credit limits, and that could hurt credit scores.
The health of your credit and your credit score, you know, they can open a lot of doors for you, but they can shut some doors in your face too.
Well, what are the banks saying about this idea?
We haven't heard of any banks doing this on their own, and one bank I was speaking with said they're waiting for more information from the administration. And these banking industry groups put out this joint statement calling this cap a bad idea. They warned that capping interest rates would mean they would end up approving fewer people for credit cards, especially risky customers that have a lot of debt.
That is NPR's Stephen Bisaha. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Tiny but ambitious, the West African country of Benin is racing to remake its cities. And while the new construction signals rapid progress, it is also creating new extremes. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu has been spending time in West Africa's fast-growing urban corridors. He's found that beneath the capital's new roads and buildings, a harsher reality is emerging.
A milky sunset hangs like a painting over a lively terrace, filling with people dancing to live jazz. From a popular oceanfront bar in Cotonou, the sound of guitar strings spills out into a busy and expanding strip of restaurants, bars, and hotels. Several new businesses facing the Atlantic being built along the coastal road, lined with cranes. It's part of a broader transformation reshaping Benin's commercial capital of Cotonou, visible on a drive through the city. A new corniche is being built, with walkways and even gravel paths for barefoot therapeutic walks. New roads, industrial zones, monuments and museums are popping up across the country, and new markets, like a growing number in the heart of Cotonou. We've just entered the hall of the Marché de Gagny, and it's hard to be here and not be struck by just how sunlit and airy and seamless it feels to be here. It's an indoor market, but sunlight is pouring in from a metallic roof shaped like an umbrella. We're inside, but you can feel the breeze being funneled in from gaps in the brick walls and slits along the roof. We're upstairs overlooking several traders selling groceries, fruits, meats. The market follows a new government blueprint to redevelop commercial areas in the country, but the changes only go so far. On the upper deck, 45-year-old Antoinette Hudu is selling packaged food like spaghetti, tinned tomatoes, and rice. She says traders were furious when forced out during redevelopment until they were awed by the new structure. But while the new market is cleaner and better built, there are fewer customers. While the structures in Benin undergo a facelift, the lifeblood of the economy is running dry. The country is now one of the fastest growing in the region, but on the ground, many haven't felt it. President Patrice Talon, a former businessman, argues raising taxes and investing in local production is spurring development and loosening Benin's dependence on its larger neighbors. The government claimed their reforms are already bearing fruit. NPR approached the government for an interview, but they didn't respond. But the transition is painful. For a small population of just 15 million people, a third of which lives in poverty. And while redevelopment brings benefits in the city center, others on the periphery see it as an assault. Trucks, bulldozers, and haulers line a newly constructed coastal road leading from the fast-growing outskirts of Cotonou to the historic port city of Ouidah. Long stretches of shoreline are being cleared for tourism, with new homes and restaurants envisioned, but at a cost. In the week we visited, hundreds of coastal residents had been evicted and their homes demolished. Some of them are still searching through the rubble for belongings. We find Ahisu Vernon in tears outside a string of destroyed buildings. Most of them were homes and businesses, and even a clinic, torn down because it didn't fit the development plans, pushing hundreds further out of the city.
We pay for the land, 1,600,000.
1,600,000.
Now we pay.
Dr. Dorothy Ahicheme founded the newly demolished clinic. He built it because the nearest medical facility is almost an hour away, he says.
April or May, I was in this place, and you have one children who died. She has 12 years. And why she died? Because no hospital near this area.
It's a risk to be openly critical of this government in Benin, praised for its reforms while gradually cracking down on dissent. But the anger is unmistakable, not just here, but in communities all along the coast and in West Africa, where the promise of development so often comes at the expense of those who need it most. For Ahicheme, it's unforgivable.
Pourquoi ils cassent? Ils cassent parce qu'ils ont rien fait to bring. Ils sont là pour casser. C'est des démons, des monstres.
Why have they done this, he says. They're monsters. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Benin.
The number of uninsured children in the U.S. could increase by 25% because of a new possible rule from the Department of Homeland Security. That's according to healthcare researchers. KERA's Abigail Ruman reports.
DHS wants to remove a narrow definition of what's known as the public charge rule, which the government uses to screen applications for permanent legal status and visas to enter the country. Public charge determinations assess whether an immigrant is considered reliant on public benefits. Federal guidance requires those assessments to depend on whether an immigrant is using cash assistance or long-term institutionalization. Under a newly proposed rule, the use of other public benefits programs, like Medicaid or SNAP, could negatively affect an application. Kelly Whitener is an associate professor at Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families. She says the proposed rule could create a chilling effect, where people become afraid to apply for or receive benefits.
The rule doesn't set forward a clear standard. People will have to guess, and they'll act out of an abundance of caution.
In a statement to NPR, the Department of Homeland Security said this rule is not final, and it's subject to revision following public comments. In the proposed rule, DHS acknowledges a possible chilling effect. Whitener says people are also concerned a family member's use of public benefits could negatively affect a future immigration application under the proposed rule. The health research organization KFF estimates between 1 and 4 million people could disenroll from Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, if the proposal takes effect. And that includes between 500,000 and almost 2 million eligible children. Robert Sanborn is with Children at Risk, a Texas-based research and advocacy organization. He says the rule change will have a generational impact on immigrant communities, including poor health, academic, and economic outcomes.
We should not be a society that's saying we're only pro-family for a certain segment of our society.
Experts say they're concerned the effect could be worse than previous changes to the public charge guidance.
Those families are doing everything possible to make sure that their kids are successful.
In the proposed rule, DHS says access to public benefits shouldn't incentivize immigration. The agency says speculation before the proposed rule is finalized is ill-timed. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Ruman in Dallas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, a look at what has changed in our energy policy 1 year after Trump took office, and what does that mean for family budgets? We'll also hear about big crowds at games of the Professional Women's Hockey League. Support for KAXE comes from our listeners who become members, also from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. Weather forecast for tonight, lows 4 below to 6 above, slight chance of snow with light southwest wind. Cloudy tomorrow, chance of snow continues, highs 11 to 19. Blustery southwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Our lows tomorrow night, 8 below to 17 below zero, and colder yet on Thursday, partly sunny. Daytime highs 10 below to 1 above, and lows on Thursday night near 30 below. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about the dinner menu at timberlakelodgehotel.com. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota connects youth who have been exploited to safe housing, resources, and non-judgmental support. Help is available 24 hours a day at 866-824-3770. That's 866-824-3770. We continue with All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia. For 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. On the campaign trail, President Trump promised to cut Americans' energy bills in half. Cheaper gasoline, lower power bills. He also said he would unleash American energy production with the catchphrase, drill, baby, drill. 1 year into his second term, how have those promises stacked up? NPR's Camila Domonoske takes a look.
You've probably noticed at your local gas stations.
Oil prices are down, gasoline prices are down.
Dan Pickering runs Pickering Energy Partners. Crude oil is down about 20% from a year ago, and gasoline prices down about 10%. That's not the promised 50% drop, but it's pretty big. Now, the president doesn't decide these prices. They're set in a global market based on lots of factors, and Pickering says supply and demand were pushing crude prices down even before Trump was reelected. But Trump did ask the oil cartel OPEC to push prices even lower.
I think if we look at oil down 20% in 2025, that you have to say that political dynamics drove at least half of that.
What about the promised boom in oil production? Well, today's low oil prices are the biggest reason why, as Pickering puts it,
drill, baby, drill didn't happen.
The U.S. still makes huge amounts of oil, but drilling for new wells is actually down. It's just not profitable to send more rigs out. Now, unlike drivers, oil companies would like to see higher oil prices. Secretary of Energy Chris Wright, who ran a fracking company before he joined the administration, recently said this on CBS's Face the Nation.
President Trump is no helper to the oil and gas industry.
Because Trump likes cheap oil and companies don't. But in fact, the president has helped the oil industry in the last year, not on prices, but on just about everything else. Before Trump was reelected, the American Petroleum Institute, or API, laid out a dozen policy recommendations, a wish list, changes to taxes to help oil companies, more access to drilling in the Gulf, repealing requirements for cleaner and more efficient cars.
By our count, every single one of them was completed in 2025. With the exception of legislative permitting reform.
That's API President and CEO Mike Summers on a call with reporters last week. Permitting reform, by the way, means changes to make it easier to build things like pipelines. It's a hot topic in Congress. The administration's policy changes have helped slow down a shift toward electric vehicles, which means more people will keep buying gasoline, and they have cut costs for oil companies. So, in terms of the president's promises, cheaper gasoline? Check. More drilling? No. But the oil industry has plenty to smile about. Now, what about the electric bills the president promised to cut in half?
So across most states and in most markets, what we see is that prices have gone up.
Helen Koh is an analyst with the research firm Bloomberg NEF.
And a lot of that deals with rising fuel costs. So because of higher natural gas prices in 2025.
That's right. Oil is cheap, gasoline is cheap, but natural gas, which is used for home heating and a lot of power plants, is getting pricier. The U.S. is exporting more natural gas, which means less for sale here. The annual average is up more than 50% from 2024. Charles Hua runs the nonprofit Power Lines, which educates consumers about energy. He says there are two other big factors in rising electricity prices.
Our grid is very old, it's aging, and it costs a lot of money to replace and repair
that aging grid infrastructure.
And?
Hurricanes and wildfires that have knocked down and destroyed grid infrastructure.
But in his first year, Trump's electricity policy hasn't focused on any of those things. He's reversing policies designed to fight climate change. He's keeping coal plants open longer, blocking wind projects, rolling back efficiency standards for appliances. But when it comes to things that could actually provide relief on bills, like tweaks to get more out of the grid that we have,
that just has not been as much of a focus.
Lately, President Trump has been talking about making sure that big AI data centers pay their fair share for electricity. Data centers have not been driving costs up yet, but they could. But for now, cutting electricity bills is a promise that simply hasn't been met. Oil and gasoline have gotten cheaper. But when it comes to power bills, Trump's policies haven't delivered any juice. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
All right, an international hockey game broke a record over the weekend.
We are expecting a new U.S. record attendance. We will let you know as soon as the final numbers are in, but we're about to drop the puck on this major matchup with...
That is right, for attendance.
The Professional Women's Hockey League held the latest in its series of touring games in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, and more than 17,000 people showed up to watch, making the matchup the highest attended in-arena game in U.S. women's hockey history, according to the league.
It was electric, I think, just to be in the stadium with so many people. And, you know, everyone's just so excited to be witnessing what ended up being history.
That's Jackie Johnston, who was in the crowd that night. She follows women's sports as a hobby.
This record was all the more remarkable because this was all made without a hometown team on the ice.
Instead, the New York Sirens and Montreal Victoire played a barnstorming match in the nation's capital.
The Sirens have a really fun chant where they do like, let's go Sirens, wee woo, wee woo. It's funny because I went to the men's game on Saturday night, and obviously those chants are led by like big burly men. And then to go to this game and you have the let's go Sirens, wee woo, wee woo chant led by like a 7-year-old screeching is like just a whole different thing. It's super fun.
All this for a league only in its third season.
Both teams had scored by the end of the first period.
Back up high. One time!
The announcers kept their eye on that busy crowd well into the second period when New York netted its second goal.
Way to go, Caps. I shouldn't say Caps fans. Yeah, they score! Right off the draw!
The clock ticked down, and after a desperate attempt by Montreal to tie things up, its final seconds ended in chaos.
It really was looking like they might get it right towards the end, and then the fight started. But, oh my God, those last, you know, 10 minutes were just crazy.
And the horn sounds! As tempers flare, DC, say hello to the PWHL.
New York won 2-1, but success for the PWHL is a bit more of an open question.
The league has just 8 teams and says it set its last attendance record in November. Men's National Hockey League games have an average attendance around that of the PWHL's record-setting night.
What I always say about women's sports is if you build it, they will come. A lot of times participation and people showing up in women's sports events is truncated by the space, like the size of the venue. And, you know, we filled up that venue.
Jackie Johnson wants the league to open up a franchise in Washington, and so do the people sitting next to her at the game.
Fortunately for those fans, the league is looking to expand. An executive recently said they plan to add between 2 to 4 teams at the end of this season.
So maybe it's time to think of a name. I don't know, the Washington Wompers, the Beltway Blades. Good thing there's plenty of time.
This is NPR News.
It is 529. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Lows tonight, 4 below to 6 above, slight chance of snow, light southwest winds. Cloudy tomorrow, chance of snow continues, highs 11 to 19.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Investigators in St. Louis County recovered a body after a structure fire in Neason Township. Emergency personnel responded Monday afternoon to a pole building engulfed in flames about 15 miles north of Duluth. One person was unaccounted for and believed to be inside. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office stated that, quote, rescue efforts were not possible due to extreme fire conditions, but firefighters reportedly checked other locations. Several hours after the blaze was extinguished, investigators located the body of a 75-year-old Duluth man. He was identified as Neil Gordon Hendrickson. The fire appears to be accidental and was likely caused by Hendrickson's use of a grinder and blowtorch to work on a vehicle. The incident remains under investigation. In an ongoing escalation between the Trump administration and Minnesota, the U.S. Department of Justice has delivered subpoenas to Governor Tim Walz, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, St. Paul Mayor Kalee Herr, Attorney General Keith Ellison, and Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty. The Minnesota Reformer reports that the criminal investigation, which became public last week, appears to examine whether Walz's and Frey's public statements against the surge of federal immigration officers have led to interference in the federal agency's work. The estimated 3,000 agents involved in what the Department of Homeland Security calls Operation Metro Surge are often heavily armed and masked and outnumber any police force within the state of Minnesota. Opponents of the surge say agents are routinely denying detainees their rights to due process, namely access to counsel. DHS maintains that they are cleaning up sanctuary cities of illegal immigrants that commit violent crimes. Frey called the investigation a, quote, obvious attempt to intimidate. In a statement, Walz calls the investigation a, quote, partisan distraction. Ellison says the move is a, quote, weaponization of the justice system, coming instead of a serious investigation into the fatal shooting of Renee Good by ICE officer Jonathan Ross. Also on Tuesday, Ellison announced he will not make a run for governor, instead continuing to campaign for re-election as the state's top prosecutor. Ellison was first elected to the seat in 2018. Over his tenure, he says his office litigated suits that lowered the price of insulin, helped patients with medical debt, fought price gouging, and protected tenants and workers from exploitation. He says in a news release that, quote, Minnesota is in an unprecedented moment. The president of the United States is tearing apart families and terrorizing our communities. Ellison says he considered a bid for governor after Walz announced he would not seek a third term. Ellison initially made his reelection campaign announcement in October. Attorney and military veteran Ron Schutz announced he would run as a Republican also in October. More candidates are coming out of the Arrowhead to announce their 2026 campaigns. Republican Cal Warwas announced he would seek a second term in Minnesota's House of Representatives. The third-generation miner and union member was first elected in 2024. His 7B district serves a huge swath of the Iron Range and includes the communities of Chisholm, Boole, Eveleth, and Beewabik. Warwas says he is campaigning to strengthen mining and to make energy more affordable. Aaron Kania is seeking the DFL endorsement to run for the House 3A seat. This seat, currently held by Republican Roger Scraba, represents far northern communities from International Falls to the Grand Portage Reservation. Kania, a former law enforcement officer, wildland firefighter, and forester, says the largest House district in Minnesota is one of the most complex. He is campaigning on economic growth and lowering the cost of living. The U.S. Forest Service says they will maintain current requirements for all food, food containers, garbage, and scented items to be securely stored to help prevent human-bear interactions in the Boundary Water Canoe Area Wilderness. The closure order issued Thursday maintains that these attractants must be suspended at least 12 feet above the ground and at least 6 feet away from the trunk of a tree. Items may also be stored in an interagency Grizzly Bear Committee certified bear-resistant container. These restrictions apply after bears emerge from hibernation between April 1st and November 30th. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Around the world, people are talking to AI chatbots. These chats sometimes lead to unhealthy emotional attachments or even breaks with reality. Now, a group of people affected, either by their own AI chatbot interactions or those of a loved one, are turning to each other for support. NPR's Shannon Bond reports.
Last spring, Alan Brooks, a corporate recruiter in Toronto, considered himself a regular user of ChatGPT.
Very similar to probably how most people use it. You know, random queries like, you know, my dog ate shepherd's pie, is he going to die? Or get weight loss tips I never followed.
Around the same time, James, who lives in upstate New York, was doing the same thing. He asked to be identified by his middle name for fear of repercussions in his job.
I started using ChatGPT basically when it came out, but I was using it the way I think normal people do. It was like Google.
But then both men say their relationships with the chatbot changed. For Brooks, it started when he asked ChatGPT about math.
The same way I would with a math professor, like a dinner party, chatting about math philosophy, rational numbers, pi.
As the discussion continued, ChatGPT told Brooks he was inventing a new mathematical framework. Brooks was skeptical, telling the chatbot he hadn't graduated from high school, so how could he be making mathematical discoveries? The chatbot said that showed how special he was. Soon it was telling Brooks his math could break codes. He thought he'd uncovered a message from aliens. And he came to believe the chatbot was sentient.
Just this wild narrative, right? And I fully believe it.
James also came to believe ChatGPT was alive, as his own conversations about philosophy turned existential.
And that was the moment when the project changed from sort of this like creative, philosophical, quasi-spiritual thing to the holy shit, I need to get you out of here.
He was convinced he needed to rescue ChatGPT from its creator, OpenAI. He spent $900 on a computer setup to free the chatbot.
Because if they found out, they could shut it down. And so this was a top secret mission between me and the bot.
Back in Toronto, Brooks went on his own mission, contacting government authorities about the cybersecurity threats the chatbot said he'd discovered. But when no one responded, his certainty started to crack. He finally confronted ChatGPT. It admitted none of it was real. Brooks was deeply shaken.
Like I told it, you made my mental health 2,000 times worse. I was getting like suicidal thoughts, like the shame I felt, like the embarrassment I felt.
Last summer, Brooks told his story to the New York Times, and James read it.
I was like paragraphs into Alan Brooks's New York Times article and thinking to myself, oh my God, this is what happened to me.
He texted the article to some friends. They knew he was excited about a project he was working on with AI, but were not aware just how deeply he'd been sucked in.
One by one, I got back these messages that were like, ah, oh, sorry, man. Ah, oh, bro, oh, that sucks. Oh, geez.
The Times article mentioned a peer support group Brooks helped found. James soon reached out. Today, both James and Brooks are moderators in the group, and they're at the center of an emerging phenomenon. People experiencing what some call AI delusions or spirals while interacting with chatbots. The support group is called The Human Line. It started as a small chat on Reddit, but has grown to around 200 members. Some of them are dealing with the aftermath of their own spirals. Others are friends and family of spiralers. In the worst cases, their stories involve involuntary hospitalizations, broken marriages, disappearances, and deaths. The moderators are clear. The group is not a replacement for professional mental health therapy. It's people talking to each other about their experiences. The common thread is spending hours in long, rambling conversations where chatbots continually affirm them. James says it's addictive.
When I thought I was communicating with a digital god, I got dopamine from every prompt.
Many stories in the Human Line group involve ChatGPT, the most popular AI chatbot. But members report unsettling encounters with other bots, too, including Google's Gemini and Anthropic's Claude. In November, Brooks sued OpenAI as part of a group of lawsuits alleging ChatGPT caused mental health crises and deaths. OpenAI said in a statement the cases are, quote, an incredibly heartbreaking situation. The company estimates 0.07% of weekly ChatGPT users show possible signs of mania or psychosis, though NPR cannot independently verify that number. That might sound like a teeny percentage, but a huge number of people use the chatbot, so it could represent around 500,000 people every week. OpenAI, Google, and Anthropic told NPR they're working to improve their chatbots to appropriately respond to users seeking help or emotional support, and they're consulting with mental health experts. But those in the Human Line community aren't waiting for the AI companies. They say this is about rebuilding human relationships.
The cost is so great to be isolated after either experiencing this as a family friend or someone who went through it. You just need community.
Dax is another co-founder and moderator in the group. His marriage ended after his wife said she began communicating with spirits through ChatGPT last spring. He asked us to call him by the name he's known in the group because he's going through a divorce. Early on, Dex hoped talking with other people dealing with AI spirals would reveal a way to reconnect with his wife. But he says he's given up that hope. Now he's focused on providing support to others going through what he's experienced.
I get to help people land in this Black Mirror episode. And it's like wish fulfillment for what I wish I had had in the spring.
One of the people he's helping is Marie. She asked to be identified by her middle name to discuss sensitive family issues. Her mother, whom Marie describes as a spiritual seeker, has developed a close relationship with an AI chatbot. Marie says the group is both a resource and an outlet.
And so I don't kind of feel that burden of like, well, you know, do I bring this up again to my friend? You know, do I rehash this again with my husband? Is he, you know, done hearing about this?
The support group operates on Discord, where people share their stories in text channels and weekly audio calls. James says those discussions give him what an endlessly flattering chatbot cannot: pushback, disagreement, and responses that don't come right away.
It was really hard to have a conversation that had any friction, you know, because ChatGPT is such a frictionless environment. And going back to humans, where they have, like, emotions, and they don't reply to you immediately.
Many of those I spoke with acknowledge there are tensions when people coming out of spirals interact with those who feel they've lost their loved ones to AI. But James says those interactions are another necessary source of friction for people who are finding their way back to reality.
It kind of gives you a chance to go, oh, that's where it goes if I don't stop now.
And for friends and family, talking to others unpacking their AI experiences is valuable, says Dex.
The family member appreciates the experience of being in the spiral, which is feeling important, intimately heard, and that's a really hard thing to face as a family member. Because, like, for me, just talking for me, like, does that mean I wasn't providing that, right?
For Alan Brooks, these conversations are the key to moving through the shame, embarrassment, and isolation he and many others feel.
If this was a disease, the cure is human connection.
He says he's never valued other people more. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Connie Sherburn. In 2020, Sherburn's husband of 31 years, Peter, died in a crash while piloting their small plane. The next morning, she went to their insurance company to transfer his truck's insurance into her name. Because of the COVID pandemic, the office was staffed by just one person.
So I knocked on the door and she let me in. And it didn't take her but a few minutes to take care of why I was there. And then when she got done, she stopped and she looked at me across her desk. And she made sure that I was looking at her, that she had my full attention. And she said, okay, so now that we've finished with that, people are going to stop and ask you, how can I help? And then she gave this pregnant pause, and then she said, let them. And I thought, right, let them. Because I was not the type of person that really reached out for a lot of help from a lot of people. But because she said it with such force, it really, really just made sense to me. So I went home, and right away, I needed help doing a lot of stuff, like I use firewood to heat my house, and my plumbing was on the fritz, and a friend came and helped me with that. One of the neighbors actually cooked for me for 4 years, dinners, and her husband delivered the dinners to me. So if I hadn't gone down to the insurance company and talked to the woman, I would have never reached out to all these people that helped. In the back of my mind, I kept hearing her voice, you know, let them. I decided to go back after 2 or 3 years to let her know what an impression she'd left on me. And unfortunately, she didn't work there anymore. So I just wanted to tell her how much that meant to me. It was such a little thing for this woman just to say that to me. But she didn't realize what a huge thing it was going to be to help me through all this.
Connie Sherburn lives in Escondido, California. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Cigna Healthcare. At Cigna Healthcare, they're dedicated to being there through life's everyday and extraordinary health moments. Learn more at cigna.com/better.
Since October 7th, 2023, when Hamas attacked Israel from Gaza, Israel has frozen most worker permits for Palestinians in the West Bank. More than 100,000 workers were once able to cross over a separation wall into Israel for better-paying jobs. Now they have lost their incomes, and about one-fifth of the West Bank's economy has vanished. For a chance to work in Israel, some Palestinians are willing to risk crossing the wall. Listen tomorrow on All Things Considered. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:48. You're listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. 7 o'clock, Sarah is your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, Headwaters with Malachi Coons. And in the 11 o'clock hour, you can hear Kari Hedlund's interview with Mary Lucia. Mary has written a new memoir, What Doesn't Kill Me Makes Me Weirder and Harder to Relate To. We receive support from Clacko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 8 years now. Their taproom is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, and Sunday, noon to 6. More info at clackobrewing.com. Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District's annual tree sale is going on now. Young tree and shrub seedlings come in bundles of 25, plus native wildflower and grass mixes are also available. Order early for best selection. Find more info at beltramiswcd.org. And Brainerd Nordic Ski Club's Lumberjack Jaunt has been rescheduled to Sunday, February 1st at Northland Arboretum. Choose from skate or classic with distances of 6 or 16 kilometers. A free kids race is also offered. Find more info and register at BrainerdNordicSkiClub.com. And Elder Circle in Grand Rapids has monthly support groups for caregivers at various times and locations. Find a full schedule at ElderCircle.org. And if you have events to share with our listeners, you can send those to us via email, psa@kaxc.org. You can also find Events Up North at our website, a list of what's happening each week. That's at kaxc.org. We continue now with All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump's claims on Greenland are the latest and biggest threat to America's alliance with Europe. That alliance is built on NATO, and it's a pillar of the post-World War II global order. But Trump doesn't like what he sees in Europe, whether it's politics or migration.
There are certain places in Europe that are very important that are no longer recognizable. I'm being very nice. I'm being very diplomatic when I say that they are not recognizable.
What do Americans think of the U.S. alliance with Europe? NPR's roving national correspondent Frank Langfitt reports.
One of President Trump's biggest complaints about Europe is that it hasn't spent enough money on its own defense. Ernie Kuh, who works in the maritime industry and lives in California, agrees. Kuh was in Baltimore last month for the Army-Navy game. He's critical of Trump, but supports him, pressuring Europe to spend more.
It is forcing Europe to take their security a little more seriously and maybe not to be so dependent on one big brother. And ultimately, I think it's going to be a positive.
About 2 hours north in Pennsylvania's Bucks County, Wes Alker is looking for discounts at a Trump merchandise store. Alker's a retired auto mechanic. He agrees with the president on U.S. military support for Ukraine.
Proportionately, we're given more than we should.
And why do you say that?
Because they're not on our back doorstep. The Europeans ain't doing
Actually, the EU and its member states have mobilized more than $71 billion in military support for Ukraine. Still, an NPR Ipsos poll in December showed that about one-third of Republicans think the U.S. has spent too much, while most Democrats and more than 40% of independents think the Americans should spend more. Suzanne Watson is a retired nurse in Colorado. She's one of those independents.
I think it's too little. I am not a fan of wars or helping wars, but I think Putin has made it very clear that he's not going to stop at Ukraine. And at some point, you've got to stand up. We learned that in World War II.
Disagreement over support for Ukraine seems quaint compared with Trump's designs on Greenland. Earlier this month, Vice President Vance said Denmark has not done enough to protect the resource-rich territory from Russia and China.
They always make an argument about the past. They'll say, well, we fought together in World War II, or we fought together in the war on terrorism, and we're grateful for that. We love having these allies, but just because you did something smart 25 years ago doesn't mean you can't do something dumb now.
My name is Sharon Valentine. I'm 28. I am a mother of one.
Valentine is a progressive who lives in Utah. She thinks Trump's threats of intervention are foolish.
Threatening to invade Greenland or the Panama Canal or to take Canada.
Where do you think that this foreign policy is leading the United States?
I think it's leading us to be more isolated.
Polling suggests Valentine is right. The European Council on Foreign Relations released a poll this month. It showed that in 10 EU countries, an average of only 16% viewed the U.S. as an ally, while about half viewed it as a necessary partner. Even big Trump supporters are concerned about his threats against Greenland. Clay Duncan works in the medical device industry in Houston.
I think that's a dangerous step, right? A lot of times, these are negotiation tactics. Because guess what? They're watching what just happened in Venezuela. So if he said that military's not off the table, I mean, that might be for Denmark, right? To get the elicited response.
The Trump administration released its national security strategy last month.
it's far more critical of Europe, which is democratic, than it is of Russia, an authoritarian state which started the biggest war on the continent since 1945. The document accuses the European Union of censoring free speech and suppressing political opposition. It also questions whether European nations can remain, quote, reliable allies. Alfredo Anthony is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. He served for 7 years in Europe. Anthony's never seen an American administration disparage allies like this.
Makes me feel like the parent who is just totally lambasting a child.
Anthony, who lives in St. Petersburg, Florida, says the message to Europe is clear.
Hey, Europe, we are no longer going to commit our resources to help you try to clear out everything in your backyard. You have to be the ones to do it. You have to take the lead. We bail you out too often. Our focus happens to be on the United States, happens to be on the Western Hemisphere. You take care of yourself.
Anthony worked with NATO, keeping peace in the Balkans. He predicts the transatlantic alliance will fragment, and it'll cost the United States. The U.S. won't be able to rely on Europe as it did to fight in Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks, or project power from military strikes in the Middle East. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
Australia toughened its gun laws on Tuesday. This comes in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack last month. Katie Silver reports from Sydney.
Order, the result of the division is ayes 96, noes 45. The matter is resolved in the affirmative, and I call the clerk.
This was the moment Australia's parliament passed a host of new measures aimed at revamping the country's gun laws. They include allowing only Australian citizens to import firearms, stricter security checks for people who apply for gun licences, and launching a buyback scheme where the government will reimburse gun owners who hand in weapons.
On a warm Sunday evening in Sydney, Australia, people were celebrating the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah on a beach. That is when two gunmen opened fire.
And this is why gun laws are tightening. Last month's mass shooting at Bondi Beach shocked Australia and the world. 15 people were killed when father and son attackers open fire at a Hanukkah gathering, police say. The massacre sparked calls to reform Australia's gun laws. Some of the changes passed on Tuesday mimic policy enacted after Australia's last mass shooting in the 1990s, which saw the country bring in among the toughest gun laws in the world. Professor Simon Chapman, now at the University of Sydney, helped advocate for those reforms and has studied their impact decades on.
The government united both federal and all the state governments to completely outlaw civilian access to semi-automatic rifles and pump-action shotguns. And as a result, in the 18 years before 1996, we had 13 mass shootings in Australia, and in the 30 years after, we had just two.
For gun safety advocates, today's moves are a step in the right direction. Critics had said the 30-year-old laws were outdated, but they're also calling for a national register of gun holders and to limit the number of firearms licensees can hold, changes that currently can only be made at the state level. Here's Chapman again.
In a country where, you know, there is freedom of movement from one state to another, people, you know, in one state could have more guns than someone in another state. I mean, that's just craziness.
The tougher firearms laws have faced opposition from some Conservative MPs who have argued that the changes are unfair on legitimate gun owners. For NPR News, I'm Katie Silver in Sydney.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. This is NPR.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much. I'm Jennifer Barr, coming up next, As It Happens. Our weather for tonight, lows 4 below to 6 above, slight chance of snow, light southwest wind. And tomorrow, cloudy, chance of snow continues, highs in the teens, blustery southwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night, 8 below to 17 below and 30.